She couldn't hold up her arms anymore. His breath quickened as her body spasmed. Warm urine ran down her leg. She could feel his excitement even as a sense of hopelessness took over. Who was Lucy fighting for? Who cared if Lucy Bennett lived or died? Maybe Henry would be sad when he heard the news. But her parents, her old friends, even Mrs. Henderson, would probably feel nothing but relief. Finally, the inevitable. Lucy's tongue swelled in her mouth. Her vision blurred. It was useless. There was no air left for her lungs. No oxygen going to her brain. She felt herself start to give, her muscles releasing. The back of her head hit pavement. She stared up. The sky was impossibly black, pinholes of stars barely visible. The man stared down at her, the same concerned look in his eyes. Only this time, he was smiling. 2. Present day. Monday. Will Trent had never been alone in someone else's home before, unless that person was dead. As with many things in his life, he was aware that this was a trait he shared with a lot of serial killers. Fortunately, Will was an agent with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, so the empty bathrooms he searched and the deserted bedrooms he tossed all fell under the category of intrusions for the greater good. This revelation didn't help ease his mind as he walked through Sarah Linton's apartment. Will had to keep telling himself he had a legitimate reason to be here. Sarah had asked him to feed and walk the dogs while she worked an extra shift at the hospital. Barring that, they were hardly strangers. They'd known each other for almost a full year before they'd finally gotten together 2 weeks ago. Will had spent every night here since. Even before that, he'd met Sarah's parents. He'd dined at her family's table. Given all of this familiarity, his feelings of trespass didn't really add up, which still didn't stop him from feeling like a stalker. Maybe this came from the way Will felt being alone here. He was pretty sure that he was obsessed with Sarah Linton. He wanted to know everything about her. And while he wasn't seized by the urge to take off his clothes and roll around naked on her bed, at least not without Sarah there with him, he felt the compulsion to look at all the things on her shelves and in her drawers. He wanted to flip through the photo album she kept in a box in her bedroom closet. He wanted to peruse her books and scroll through her iTunes collection. Not that he would act on these impulses. Unlike most serial killers, Will was aware that any one of these things crossed the line into creepy. But the desire left him feeling unsettled all the same. He looped the dog's leashes around the hook inside the hall closet. Sarah's two greyhounds were piled onto the living room couch. A ray of sun bleached their fawn-colored fur. The loft was a penthouse corner unit, which was one of the perks of being a pediatrician instead of a lowly civil servant. The L-shaped wall of windows gave a stellar view of downtown Atlanta. The Bank of America Plaza that looked like the builders had forgotten to remove the scaffolding up top. The step-like Georgia Pacific Tower that was built over the movie theater where Gone with the Wind premiered. The tiny Equitable building sitting like a black granite paperweight beside the pencil cup of the Westin Peachtree Plaza. Atlanta was a small town in the scheme of things. The population inside the city limits was slightly north of 500,000. Bump that out to the metro area, and it was closer to 6 million. The city was a mecca on the Piedmont, the center of business in the southeast. Over 60 languages were spoken here. There were more hotel rooms than residents, more office spaces than people. 300 murders a year, 1,100 reported rapes, nearly 13,000 aggravated assault charges. More like a small town with a chip on its shoulder. Will made his way to the kitchen and picked up the water bowls from the floor. The thought of going home to his small house made him feel lonely, which was strange considering Will had grown up wanting to be nothing but alone. There was more to his life than Sarah Linton. He was a grown man. He had a job. He had his own dog to look after. He had a home. He'd even been married before. Technically, he was still married, though that hadn't mattered much until recently. Will was 8 years old when the cops dropped off Angie Pulaski at the Atlanta Children's Home. She was 11 and a girl, which meant she stood a good chance of being adopted. But Angie was mouthy and wild, and no one wanted her. No one wanted Will, either. He'd spent most of his early life being checked in and out of the children's home like a dog-eared library book. Somehow, Angie made all of it more bearable. Except for the times when she was making it unbearable. Their marriage had taken place 2 years ago. It had been perpetrated on a double dog dare, which might explain why neither of them took it very seriously. Angie had lasted less than a week. 2 days after the civil ceremony, Will woke up to find her clothes gone, the house empty. He wasn't surprised. He wasn't hurt. Actually, he was enormously relieved that it had happened sooner rather than later. Angie disappeared on him all the time. Will knew that she would be back. She always came back. Only this time, for the first time, something had happened while Angie was away. There was Sarah. There was the way she breathed in Will's ear. There was the way she traced her fingers down his spine. There was her taste, her smell. There were all these things Will had never even noticed with Angie. He clicked his tongue as he put down the water bowls. The dog stayed on the couch, unimpressed. Will's Glock was on the counter beside his suit jacket. He clipped the holster onto his belt. He checked the time on the stove as he pulled on his jacket. Sarah's shift ended in 5 minutes, which meant it was at least 10 minutes past time for Will to leave. She would probably call him when she got home. He would tell her he was doing paperwork or about to get on the treadmill or some other lie that made it clear he hadn't been sitting around waiting for her to call. And then he would run back over here like Julie Andrews prancing up that hill in The Sound of Music. He was heading to the front door when his cell phone vibrated in his pocket. Will recognized his boss's number. For a split second, he considered sending the call to voicemail. But he knew from experience that Amanda would not be easily deterred. He answered, "Trent,
where are you?"
For some reason, he found the question intrusive.
"Why?"
Amanda gave a weary sigh. He could hear noises on her end, the low murmur of a crowd, a repetitive clicking sound.
"Just answer me, Will."
"I'm at Sarah's." She didn't respond, so he asked,
"Do you need me?" "No, I most certainly do not. You're still on airport duty until further notice. Do you understand me? Nothing else."
He stared at the phone for a moment, then put it back to his ear.
"All right."
Abruptly, she ended the call. Will had the distinct feeling she would have slammed down the receiver, if such a thing were possible, on a cell phone. Instead of leaving, he stood in the foyer, trying to figure out what had just happened. Will replayed the conversation in his head. No obvious explanation jumped out. Will was used to his boss being obtuse. Anger was hardly a new emotion. But while Amanda had certainly hung up on him before, Will couldn't fathom why she cared where he was at the moment. Actually, he was surprised that she was even talking to him. He hadn't heard her voice in 2 weeks. Deputy Director Amanda Wagner was an old-timer, from that group of cops who easily bent the rules to make a case, but stuck to the manual when it came to the dress code. The GBI required all non-undercover agents to keep their hair half an inch off their collars. 2 weeks ago, Amanda had actually slapped a ruler to the back of Will's neck. And when he hadn't taken the hint, she'd transferred him to airport duty, which required Will to hang out in various men's toilets, waiting for someone to sexually proposition him. Will's mistake was mentioning the ruler to Sarah. He'd told her the story as a sort of joke, as well as an explanation for why he needed to run up the street to the barber shop before they went to dinner. Sarah hadn't told Will not to get his hair cut. She was so much smarter than that. She'd told him she liked his hair the length that it was. She'd told him that it looked good on him. She'd stroked the back of his neck while she said this, and then she had suggested that instead of going to the barber, they go into the bedroom and do something so filthy that Will had experienced a few seconds of hysterical blindness, which was why he was looking at spending the rest of his career doing a Mr. Bojangles under the bathroom stall of every men's toilet in the busiest passenger airport in the world. But it didn't explain why Amanda had felt the need to locate Will on this particular day at this particular time, or the sound of people gathered in the background, or the familiar clicking noise. Will went back into the living room. The dogs shifted on the couch. But Will didn't sit down. He picked up the remote and turned on the television. A basketball game was on. He flipped to the local station. Monica Pearson, the Channel 2 anchor, was sitting behind her news desk. She was doing a story on the Beltline, the new transportation system that was hated by everyone in Atlanta, except for the politicians. Will's finger was on the power button when the story changed. Breaking news. The image of a young woman appeared over Pearson's shoulder. Will turned up the volume as the story was tossed to a live news conference. What he saw made him sit down. Amanda Wagner stood at a wooden podium. A handful of microphones were in front of her. She was waiting for silence. Will heard the familiar sounds. Cameras clicking over the low murmur of the crowd. He'd seen his boss do hundreds of news conferences. Usually, Will was in the back of the room trying to stay off camera, while Amanda basked in the glow of undivided attention. She loved being in charge. She lived to control the slow trickle of information that fed the media. Except for now. Will studied her face as the camera closed in. She looked tired. More than that, she looked worried. She said, "The Georgia Bureau of Investigation has released an alert bulletin on Ashley Renee Snyder. The 19-year-old female was reported missing at approximately 3:15 this afternoon." Amanda paused, giving the newspaper journalist time to scribble down the description. "Ashley lives in the Techwood area and is a sophomore at the Georgia Institute of Technology." Amanda said more, but Will tuned out the words. He watched her mouth move. He saw her point to different reporters. Their questions were long. Her answers were brief. She didn't put up with much. There was none of her usual bantering back and forth. Finally, Amanda left the podium. Monica Pearson returned. The photo of the missing girl was back over her shoulder. Blonde, pretty, thin. Familiar. Will took his phone out of his pocket. He touched his thumb to the speed dial for Amanda, but didn't press the number. By state law, the GBI had to be asked by the local police before they could take over a case. One of the rare exceptions was with kidnappings, where timing was critical and abductors could quickly cross county and state lines. An alert bulletin would mobilize all of the GBI field offices, agents would be called back in, any collected evidence would be given top priority at the labs. All the agency's resources would be directed toward this one case. Every resource but Will. He probably shouldn't read anything into this. It was just another way Amanda had found to punish him. She was still mad about Will's hair. She was petty enough to make a point of keeping him off a case. That was all it was. Will had worked kidnappings before. They were awful cases. They seldom ended well. Still, every cop wanted to work one. The ticking clock, the tension, the chase. The adrenaline jolt was part of the reason they joined in the first place. And Amanda was punishing Will by keeping him off the case. Techwood, a student. Will turned off the TV. He felt a drop of sweat slide down his back. His mind couldn't settle on any one particular thought. Finally, he shook his head to clear it. That was when he noticed the time on the cable box. Sarah's shift had ended 12 minutes ago. Crap. Will had to move the dogs before he could stand up. He headed to the front door. Abel Conford, Sarah's neighbor, was in the hallway waiting for the elevator.
"Good after."
Will ducked into the stairwell. He took the steps two at a time, eager to leave so Sarah wouldn't think he'd been mooning over her. She lived a few blocks from the hospital. She would be here any minute. She was actually already here. Will saw her sitting in her BMW as soon as he opened the lobby door. For a foolish split second, he considered darting into the trees. Then he realized that Sarah had already seen his car. His 79 Porsche was parked nose out beside her brand new SUV. Will couldn't open his door without hitting Sarah's. He muttered under his breath as he plastered a smile onto his face. Sarah didn't return it. She was just sitting there gripping the steering wheel, staring straight ahead. He walked toward the car. The sun was bright enough to turn her windshield into a mirror, so he didn't notice until he was right up on her that she had tears in her eyes. Instantly, his issue with Amanda ceased to matter. Will pulled the handle on the door. Sarah unlocked it from the inside. He asked, "You okay?"
"Yep."
She turned around to face him, propping her feet on the running board.
"Bad day at work."
"Want to talk about it?"
"Not really, but thank you."
She traced her fingers along the side of his face, tucked his hair behind his ear. Will leaned in closer. All he could do was look at her. Sarah's auburn hair was pulled back into a ponytail. The sunlight brought out the intense green of her eyes. She was wearing her hospital scrubs. There were a few drops of dried blood on the sleeve. She had a series of numbers scribbled on the back of her hand, blue ink on milky white skin. All the patient charts at Grady were on digital tablets. Sarah used the back of her hand to calculate dosages for patients. Knowing this last week would have saved Will two sleepless nights of insane jealousy. But he wasn't one to quibble. She asked,
"Were the dogs okay?"
"They did all the things dogs are supposed to do."
"Thank you for taking care of them."
Sarah rested her hands on his shoulders. Will felt a familiar stirring. It was like there was an invisible string between them. The slightest tug, and he was incapacitated. She stroked the back of his neck.
"Tell me about your day."
"Boring and sad," he answered, which was mostly true. "Some old guy told me I have a nice package." She gave a sly smile.
"Can't arrest him for being honest."
He was pleasuring himself when he said it.
"That sounds like something fun to try."
Will felt the string go taut. He kissed her. Sarah's lips were soft. They tasted like peppermint from the lip balm she used. Her fingernails scratched into his hair. He leaned in closer. And then everything stopped when the front door to the building banged open.
Abel Conford gave them a scowl as he stomped toward his Mercedes. Will had to clear his throat before he could ask Sarah,
"Are you sure you don't want some time to yourself?"
She adjusted the knot in his tie.
"I want to go for a walk with you, and then I want to eat an entire pizza with you, and then I want to spend the rest of the night with you."
Will looked down at his watch.
"I think I can fit that in."
Sarah slid out of the car and locked the door. Will tucked the key fob into his pocket. The plastic hit the familiar cold metal of his wedding ring. Will had taken off the ring 2 weeks ago, but for reasons he couldn't begin to decipher, that was as far as he'd gotten. Sarah took his hand as they walked down the sidewalk. Atlanta was at its most spectacular in late March, and today was no exception. A light breeze cooled the air. Every yard was packed with flowers. The oppressive heat of the summer months seemed like an old wives' tale. The sun cut through the swaying trees, lighting up Sarah's face. Her tears had dried, but Will could see that she was still troubled about what had happened at the hospital. He asked,
"Sure you're okay?"
Instead of answering, Sarah wrapped his arms around her shoulders. She was a few inches shorter than Will, which meant she fit like a puzzle piece under his arm. He felt her hand slip up under his suit jacket. She hooked her thumb over the top of his belt, just shy of his Glock. They passed the usual foot traffic in the neighborhood, joggers, occasional couples, men pushing baby strollers, women walking dogs. Most of them were on their cell phones, even the runners. Sarah finally spoke.
"I lied to you."
He
He glanced down at her.
About what?
I didn't pull an extra shift at the hospital. I stayed around because... Her voice trailed off. She looked out into the street. Because no one else was there. Will didn't know what else to say, but...
Okay.
Her shoulders went up as she took a deep breath. An 8-year-old boy was brought in around lunchtime. Sarah was the pediatric attending in Grady's ER. She saw a lot of kids in bad shape. He OD'd on his grandmother's blood pressure meds. He took half her 90-day supply.
It was hopeless.
Will kept silent, giving her time. His heart rate was less than 40 when they brought him in. We lavaged him. We ran through the glucagon, maxed out on dopamine, epinephrine. Her voice got softer with each word. There was nothing else I could do. I called the cardiologist to put in a pacemaker, but Sarah shook her head again. We had to let him go. We ended up shipping him to the ICU. Will saw a black Monte Carlo coasting down the street. The windows were down. Rap music shook the air. Sarah said, I couldn't leave him alone. His attention moved away from the car.
Weren't the nurses there?
The ward was already packed. Again, she shook her head. His grandmother wouldn't come to the hospital. Mom's in jail. Dad's unknown. No other relatives. He wasn't conscious. He didn't even know I was there. She paused a moment. It took him 4 hours to die. His hands were already cold when we moved him upstairs. She stared down at the sidewalk. Jacob. His name was Jacob. Will chewed at the inside of his mouth. He'd been in and out of Grady as a kid. The hospital was the only publicly funded facility left in Atlanta. He said, Jacob was lucky to have you. She tightened her grip around him. Her gaze was still lowered, as if the cracks in the sidewalk needed further study. They walked on, both silent. Will felt a weight of expectancy. He knew that Sarah was thinking about Will's childhood. The fact that his own life could have ended the same way Jacob's had. Will should at least acknowledge this, remind her that the system had done better by him than most. But he couldn't find the words. Hey, Sarah tugged at the back of Will's shirt. We should probably turn around. She was right. The foot traffic had thinned out. They were nearing Boulevard, which wasn't the best place to be this time of day. Will glanced up, blinking at the bright sun. There were no tall buildings or skyscrapers blocking the light. Just rows and rows of government-subsidized housing. Techwood had been like this neighborhood, up until the mid-90s when the Olympics had changed everything. The city had razed the slums. The inhabitants had been moved farther south. Students lived in the upscale apartment buildings now. Students like Ashley Snyder. Will spoke before he could stop himself. Why don't we go up that way? Sarah gave him a curious look. He was pointing toward the projects. He said, I want to show you something. Around here? It's just a few blocks this way. Will pulled at her shoulder to get her going again. They crossed another street, stepping over a pile of litter. Graffiti was everywhere. Will could practically feel the hair standing up on the back of Sarah's neck. She asked, Are you sure about this?
Trust me,
he said, though as if on cue, they approached a seedy-looking clump of shirtless teenagers. All of them sported scowls and low-hanging jeans. They were a veritable rainbow coalition of tweakers, representing almost every ethnicity Atlanta had to offer. One of them had a small swastika tattooed on his fish-white belly. Another had a Puerto Rican flag on his chest. Ball caps were turned backward, teeth were missing or covered in gold. All of them held liquor-shaped brown paper bags in their hands. Sarah leaned closer to Will. He stared back at the kids. Will was 6'3" on a good day, but pulling back his jacket sent the stronger message. Nothing discouraged conversation more than the 14 rounds in a government-issued Glock Model 23. Wordlessly, the group turned and headed in the opposite direction. Will let his eyes track them just to make it clear they should keep moving.
"Where are we going?" Sarah asked. She obviously hadn't planned on their afternoon stroll turning into a tour of one of the city's most crime-ridden areas. They were in the full glare of the sun now. There was no shade in this part of town. No one planted flowers in their front yards. Unlike the dogwood-lined streets in the more affluent areas, there was nothing here but bright xenon streetlights and clear open spaces so the police helicopters could track stolen cars or fleeing perpetrators.
"Just a little bit more," Will said, rubbing her shoulder in what he hoped was a soothing manner.
They walked silently for a few more blocks. He could feel Sarah tense up the farther they got from home. Will asked,
"Do you know what this area is called?"
Sarah glanced around at the street signs.
"Sono? Old Fourth Ward?"
"It used to be called Buttermilk Bottom." She smiled at the name.
"Why?"
"It was a slum. No paved streets, no electricity. See how steep the grade is?" She nodded. "The sewage used to back up here. They said it smelled like buttermilk." Will saw she wasn't smiling anymore. He dropped his arm to Sarah's waist as they turned onto Carver Street. He pointed to the boarded-up coffee shop on the corner.
"That used to be a grocery store."
She looked up at him.
"Mrs. Flanagan sent me there every day after school to buy her a pack of Cool 100s and a bottle of Tab."
"Mrs. Flanagan?"
"She ran the children's home."
Sarah's expression didn't change, but she nodded. Will felt an odd sensation in his belly, like he'd swallowed a handful of hornets. He didn't know why he'd brought Sarah here. He wasn't generally impulsive. He'd never been one to volunteer details about his life. Sarah knew Will had grown up in care. She knew that his mother had died shortly after he was born. Will assumed she'd figured out the rest on her own. Sarah wasn't just a pediatrician. She'd been the medical examiner back in her small town. She knew what abuse looked like. She knew what Will looked like. Given her training, it wasn't hard to put together the clues.
"Record shop," Will said, pointing out another abandoned building.
He kept his arm around her waist, guiding her toward their ultimate destination. The hornet's sensation got worse. Ashley Snyder kept flashing into his mind. The photo they showed on the news must have been from her student ID card. The girl's blonde hair was pulled back. Her lips showed an amused smile, as if the photographer had said something funny. Sarah asked, "Where did you live?" Will stopped. They had almost passed the children's home. The building was so changed that it was barely recognizable. The Spanish Revival brick architecture had been completely bastardized. Large metal awnings eyebrowed the front windows. The red brick had been painted a roomy yellow. Chunks of the facade were missing. The huge wooden front door that had been gloss black as long as Will could remember was now a garish red. The glass was caked with dirt. In the yard, Mrs. Flanagan's white-painted tires no longer held tulips and pansies. They were no longer white, either. Will was afraid to guess what was inside them now, and he didn't want to get close enough to find out. There was a sign slapped onto the side of the building. "Coming soon, luxury condos," Sarah read.
"Not too soon, I'm guessing."
Will stared up at the building.
"It didn't used to be like this."
Sarah's reluctance was palpable, but she still asked, "Do you want to look inside?" He wanted to run away from here as fast as he could, but Will forced himself to walk up the front steps. As a kid, he'd always felt a certain amount of dread every time he entered the home. There were new boys constantly in and out. Each of them had something to prove, sometimes with their fists. This time it wasn't physical violence that sent a cold fear through Will. It was Ashley Snyder. It was the unreasonable connection Will was making because the missing girl looked so much like his mother. He pressed his face close to the window, but couldn't see anything other than the reflection of his own eyes staring back. The front door was secured with an expensive-looking padlock,
The wood was so rotted that one yank on the hasp pulled out the screws. Will hesitated, his palm flat to the door. He felt Sarah standing behind him, waiting. He wondered what she would do if he changed his mind and walked back down the stairs. As if sensing his thoughts, she said, "We can go." Then more pointedly, "Why don't we go?" Will pushed open the door. There was no expected creaking of hinges, but the door caught on the warped wooden floor so that he had to shove it open. Will tested the floorboards as he entered. Though it was still light out, the house was dark, thanks mostly to the heavy awnings and dirty windows. A musky smell greeted him. Nothing like the welcoming scent of Pine Sol and Cool 100s Will recalled from his childhood. He tried the light switch to no avail. Sarah said, "Maybe we should..."
Looks like it was turned into a hotel.
Will pointed to the caged front desk, keys still hung from the cubbyholes along the back wall.
Or a halfway house.
Will glanced around what he guessed was the lobby. Broken glass pipes and tinfoil littered the floor. The crack addicts had demolished the couch and chairs. There were several used condoms melted into the carpet.
"My God,"
Sarah whispered. Will felt oddly defensive. "Picture it with the walls painted white and the sofa this big, yellow kind of corduroy sectional." He looked down at the floor.
"Same carpet. It was a lot cleaner, though."
Sarah nodded, and he walked toward the back of the building before she could run out the front. The large, open spaces from Will's childhood had been chopped up into single-room apartments. But he could still remember what it had looked like in better times. He told Sarah,
"This was the dining hall. There were 12 tables, kind of like picnic benches, but with tablecloths and nice napkins. Boys on one side, girls on the other. Mrs. Flanagan was careful about letting the girls and boys mingle too much. She said she didn't need more kids than she already had."
Sarah didn't laugh at the joke.
"Here."
Will stopped in front of an open doorway. The room was a dark hole. He could easily picture how it used to be. Flowery wallpaper. A metal desk and wooden chair.
"This was Mrs. Flanagan's office."
"What happened to her?"
"Heart attack. She died before the ambulance got here."
He continued down the hallway and pushed open a familiar-looking swinging door.
"The kitchen, obviously."
This space at least hadn't changed.
"That's the same stove from when I was a kid."
Will opened the pantry door. There was still food stacked on the shelves. Mold had turned a loaf of bread into a black brick. Graffiti marred the back of the door. "Fuck you, fuck you, fuck you," was carved into the soft wood. Sarah said, "Looks like the attic's redecorated."
"That was always there,"
Will admitted.
"This was where you had to go if you acted up."
Sarah pressed her lips together as she studied the bolt on the door. Will said,
"Trust me, being locked in a pantry wasn't the worst thing that ever happened to a lot of these kids."
He saw the question in her eyes.
"I was never locked in there."
She gave him a strained smile.
"I should hope not. It wasn't as bad as you're thinking. We had food, we had a roof over our heads, we had a color TV. You know how much I love watching television."
She nodded, and he led her back into the hallway toward the front stairs. He tapped a closed door along the way.
"Basement."
"Did Mrs. Flanagan lock kids down there, too?"
"It was off limits,"
Will answered, though he happened to know that Angie had spent a lot of time down there with the older boys. Carefully, Will walked up the stairs, testing each step before letting Sarah follow. The scruffy treads were just as he remembered, but he had to duck at the top of the landing to keep from smacking his head on a structural beam.
"Back here."
He took purposeful strides down the hallway, acting as if this was exactly what he'd planned to do with his evening. As with downstairs, the space was divided into single rooms that met with the needs of the prostitutes, drug addicts, and alcoholics who'd likely rented space by the hour. Most of the doors were open or hanging off their hinges. The plaster around the baseboards had been nibbled away by rats. The walls were probably crawling with their offspring, or cockroaches, or both. Will stopped at the next-to-last door and pushed it open with his foot. An iron cot and a smashed wooden table were the only contents. The carpet was a fecal brown. The one window in the room was cut in half, the other side shared with the next-door neighbor.
My bed was here against the wall. Bunk bed. I got the top.
Sarah didn't respond. Will turned around to look at her. She was biting her lip in a way that made him think that the pain was the only thing keeping her from crying.
I know it looks awful, he said, but it wasn't like this when I was a kid, I promise. It was nice. It was clean.
It was an orphanage. The word echoed in his head like she'd shouted it down a well. There was no getting past this difference between them. Sarah had grown up with two loving parents, a doting sister, and a stable, solidly middle-class life. And Will had grown up here.
Will, she asked. What just happened?
He rubbed his chin.
Why was he such an idiot?
Why did he keep making mistakes with Sarah that he'd never made with anyone else in his life? There was a reason he didn't talk about his childhood. People felt pity when they should have felt relief.
Will, I'll take you home. I'm sorry.
Please don't be. This is your home, was your home. It's where you grew up.
It's a flop house in the middle of a slum. We're probably going to get stabbed by a junkie as soon as we leave.
She laughed. It's not funny, Sarah. It's dangerous here. Half the crime in the city happens. I know where we are. She put her hands on either side of his face.
Thank you.
For what? Making you need a tetanus shot?
For sharing part of your life with me.
She gently kissed him on the lips.
Thank you.
Will stared into her eyes, wishing he could read her mind. He didn't understand Sarah Linton. She was kind. She was honest. She wasn't storing up information to later use against him. She wasn't jabbing her thumb into open wounds. She wasn't anything like any woman he'd ever met in his life. Sarah kissed him again. She stroked his hair back over his ear.
Sweetheart, I know that look, and it's not going to happen here.
Will opened his mouth to respond, but stopped when he heard the sound of a car door slamming. Sarah jumped at the noise, her fingers digging into his arm.
It's a busy street,
Will told her, but he still went to the front of the house to investigate. Through the broken window at the end of the hallway, he saw a black Suburban parked at the curb. The glass was smoked black. The freshly washed exterior sparkled in the sun. The back end was lower than the front because of the large metal gun cabinet bolted into the rear of the SUV. Will told Sarah,
that's a G-Ride.
A government-issued vehicle. Amanda drove one exactly like it, so he shouldn't have been surprised to see her get out of the Suburban. She was talking on her BlackBerry. A hammer was in her other hand. The claw was long and nasty. She swung it at her side as she walked toward the front door. Sarah asked,
"What's she doing here?"
She tried to look out the window, but Will pulled her back.
"Why does she have a hammer?"
Will didn't answer. Couldn't answer. There was no reason for Amanda to be here. No reason for her to call and ask Will where he was. No reason to tell him to report to the airport like she was giving a child a time out in the corner. Amanda's voice carried through the closed window as she talked on the phone.
That's unacceptable. I want the full team answering to me. No exceptions.
The front door opened. It creaked this time. Will heard footsteps across the floor. Amanda made a disgusted noise.
This is my case, Mike. I'll work it how I see fit.
Sarah whispered.
What is she?
Will's expression must have stopped her. His jaw felt clamped shut. He was gripped by a sudden, inexplicable fury. He held up his hand, indicating Sarah should stay there. Before she could argue, Will headed down the stairs, stepping carefully so the treads wouldn't creak. He was sweating again. The hornets in his gut had worked their way into his chest, trapping his breath.
Amanda tucked her BlackBerry in her back pocket. She gripped the hammer in her hand as she started down the basement stairs. He said, "Amanda." She spun around, grabbing the handrail for support. There was no mistaking the look on her face for anything but absolute shock.
"What are you doing here?
Is the girl still missing?" She didn't move from the top stair. She was obviously still too shocked to speak. He repeated his question.
"Is the girl still?"
"Yes."
"Then why are you here?" "Go home, Will."
He'd never heard anything like fear in her voice, but he could tell now that she was deathly afraid. Not of Will, but of something else.
"Just let me handle this."
"Handle what?" She rested her hand on the doorknob as if she wanted nothing more than to close him out.
"Go home."
"Not until you tell me why you're alone in an abandoned building when there's an active case." She raised an eyebrow.
"I'm not actually alone, am I?"
"Tell me what's going on."
"I'm not..."
Her words were cut off by a loud crack. Panic filled her eyes. Another crack came like a shotgun blast. Amanda started to fall. She clutched the doorknob. Will lunged to help, but he was too late. The door slammed closed as the stairs collapsed. The noise rumbled through the building like a charging freight train. Then, nothing. Will jerked open the door. The knob rattled at his feet. He stared down into absolute blackness. Uselessly, he flicked the light switch up and down.
"Amanda?" he called.
His voice echoed back at him.
"Amanda!"
"Will?" Sarah was on the landing. She quickly took in what had happened. "Give me your phone." Will tossed her the phone. He took off his jacket and holster and got down on the floor. Sarah said, "You are not going down there." Will froze, startled by the order, the unfamiliar, sharp tone of her voice. "We're in a crack house, Will. There could be needles down there, broken glass. It's too dangerous." She held up her finger as the phone was obviously answered on the other end. "This is Dr. Linton from the ER. I need a bus and rescue sent to Carver Street for an officer down." Will provided. "Street number 316. He sat on his knees and leaned his head into the basement as Sarah rattled off the details.
"Amanda?"
He waited. No response.
"Can you hear me?"
Sarah ended the call. "They're on their way. Just stay there until..."
"Amanda!"
Will glanced around the hallway, trying to put together a plan. Finally, he turned around and got down on his belly. Sarah pleaded.
"Will, don't."
He elbowed back until his feet hung down into the basement. "You're going to fall." He edged back farther, expecting any moment for his feet to hit solid ground. "There are broken pieces of wood down there. You could shatter your ankle. You could land on Amanda." Will gripped the edge of the door jambs with his fingers, praying that his arms wouldn't give. Which they eventually did. He dropped straight down like the blade on a guillotine.
"Will?"
Sarah was in the open doorway. She got down on her knees.
"Are you all right?"
Pieces of wood poked into his back like sharp fingers. Sawdust filled the air. Will's nose had banged into his knee so hard that pinpoints of light exploded in front of his eyes. He touched the side of his ankle. A nail had scraped across the bone. His teeth ached at the memory.
"Will?"
Sarah's tone rose in alarm.
"Will!" "I'm all right."
He felt his ankle squick as he moved. Blood pooled into the heel of his shoe. He tried to make light of the situation.
"Looks like I was right about needing that tetanus shot."
She mumbled a shocking expletive. Will tried to stand, but his feet couldn't find purchase. He blindly reached out, thinking Amanda was close by. He got on his knees, leaning out farther, and finally was rewarded with a foot. Her shoe was missing. Her pantyhose were torn.
"Amanda?"
Carefully, Will picked his way across the shards of wood and broken nails. He put his hand on her shin, then her thigh. He gently felt along until he found her arm folded over her stomach. Amanda moaned. Will's stomach roiled as his fingers followed the unnatural angle of her wrist. Amanda, he repeated. She moaned again. Will knew she'd have a maglight in the Suburban. He dug his fingers into the front pockets of her jeans, trying to find her keys. He could send Sarah out to the car. She would have to search for the flashlight. He would tell her it was in the glove compartment or one of the locked drawers. She would spend several minutes looking for the light, which was exactly what Will needed. Amanda? He checked her back pockets. The tips of his fingers brushed along the broken plastic case on her BlackBerry. Suddenly, Amanda's good hand clamped around his wrist. She asked,
"Where's Michael?"
Will stopped searching for the keys.
"Amanda, it's Will. Will Trent."
Her tone was terse.
"I know who you are, Wilbur."
Will felt his body go rigid. Only Angie called him Wilbur. It was the name on his birth certificate. Sarah asked, "Is she okay?" Will had to swallow before he could speak.
"I think her wrist is broken."
"How's her respiration?" He listened for the cadence of her breath, but all he could hear was his own blood pounding in his ears. Why was Amanda here? She should be out looking for the missing girl. She should be leading the team. She shouldn't be here, in this basement, with a hammer. "Will?" Sarah's tone was softer now. She was worried about him. He asked, "How long before the ambulance gets here?"
"Not much longer. Are you sure you're all right?" "I'm fine."
Will put his hand on Amanda's foot again. He could feel a steady pulse near her ankle. He'd worked for this moment most of his career, but still knew very little about her. She lived in a condo in the heart of Buckhead. She had been on the job longer than he had been alive, which put her age in the mid-60s. She kept her salt-and-pepper hair coiffed in the shape of a football helmet and wore pantyhose with starched blue jeans. She had a sharp tongue, more degrees than a college professor, and she knew that his name was Wilbur, even though he'd had it legally changed when he entered college, and every piece of paper the GBI had on file listed his legal name as William Trent. He cleared his throat again so that he could ask Sarah,
"Is there anything I should be doing?"
"No, just stay where you are." Sarah used a raised, clear tone Will thought of as her doctor's voice. "Amanda, this is Dr. Linton. Can you tell me today's date?" She groaned out a pained breath.
"I told Edna to shore up those steps a million times."
Will sat back on his heels. Something sharp pressed against his knee. He felt blood sliding across his ankle, dripping through his sock. His heart was pounding so hard that he was sure Sarah could hear it.
"Will,"
Amanda mumbled.
"What time is it?"
Will couldn't answer her. His mouth felt wired shut. Sarah took over, saying, "It's 5:30.
"In the evening,"
Amanda said, not a question.
"We're at the children's home. I fell down the basement stairs."
She lay there taking deep breaths of the pungent air.
"Dr. Linton, am I going to live?"
"I'd be very surprised if you didn't."
"Well, I suppose that's as much as I can ask for right now. Did I lose consciousness?"
"Yes," Sarah answered, "for about 2 minutes. Amanda spoke, more to herself.
"I don't know what that means. Are you touching my foot?"
Will pulled away his hand.
"I can move my toes."
Amanda sounded relieved.
"My head feels like it's been cracked open."
He heard movement, the rustling of clothes.
"No, nothing sticking out. No blood, no soft spots. God, my shoulder hurts."
Will tasted blood. His nose was bleeding. He used the back of his hand to wipe his mouth. Amanda let out another heavy sigh.
"I'll tell you what, Will. You get past a certain age and a broken bone or a cracked head is no laughing matter. It's with you for the rest of your life. What's left of the rest of your life."
She was quiet for a few seconds. From the sound of it, she was trying to keep her breathing steady. Despite the fact that he was obviously not going to answer, she told Will,
"When I joined the Atlanta Police Department, there was a whole division assigned to checking our appearance. The inspection division. 6 full-duty officers. I'm not making that up.
Will glanced up at Sarah. She shrugged.
They would show up during roll call. And if you didn't fix what they told you to fix, you were suspended without pay.
He put his hand to his watch, wishing he could feel the second hand ticking by. Grady Hospital was only a few blocks away. There was no reason for the ambulance to be taking so long. They knew Amanda was a cop. They knew she needed help.
Amanda said, I remember the first time I rolled up on a Signal 45. Some jackass had a CB radio stolen out of his car. We were always getting 45s on CB radios. They had those big antennas pointing like arrows off their back bumpers.
Again, Will glanced up at Sarah. She made a circling motion, indicating he should keep Amanda talking. Will's throat was too tight. He couldn't force out the words, couldn't pretend that they were all just a bunch of friends who'd had a bad day. Amanda didn't seem to need encouragement. She chuckled under her breath.
They laughed at me. They laughed at me when I got there. They laughed at me when I took the report. They laughed at me when I left. No one thought women should be in uniform. The station would get calls every week, someone reporting that a woman had stolen a squad car. They couldn't believe we were on the job.
Sarah said, I think they're here, just as Will heard the distant wail of a siren. I'll go wave them down. Will waited until Sarah's footsteps were on the front porch. It took everything in him not to grab Amanda by the shoulders and shake her.
Why are you here? Is Sarah gone?
Why are you here? Amanda's tone turned uncharacteristically gentle.
I have to tell you something. I don't care, he shot back. How did you know? Shut up and listen, she hissed. Are you listening?
Will felt the dread come flooding back. The siren was louder. The ambulance braked hard in front of the house.
Are you listening?
Will found himself speechless again.
It's about your father.
She said more, but Will's ears felt muffled, as if he was listening to her voice underwater. As a kid, Will had ruined the earpiece to his transistor radio that way, putting the bud in his ear, dunking his head in the bathtub, thinking that would be a cool new way to hear music. It had been in this very house, 2 floors up in the boys' bathroom. He was lucky he hadn't electrocuted himself. There was a loud thunk overhead as paramedics shoved open the front door. Heavy footsteps banged across the floor. The bright beam of a mag light suddenly filled the basement. Will blinked in the glare. He felt dizzy. His lungs ached for breath. Amanda's words came rushing back to him the same way sound had come back to his ears when he'd grabbed the sides of the tub and thrust his head above water.
Listen to me, she'd ordered.
But he didn't want to. He didn't want to know what she had to say. The parole board had met. They had let Will's father out of prison. 3. October 15th, 1974. Lucy Bennett. Lucy had lost track of time once the symptoms had subsided. She knew it took heroin 3 days to fully leave your bloodstream. She knew that the sweats and sickness lasted a week or more, depending on how far gone you were. The stomach cramps, the throbbing pain in your legs, the alternating constipation and diarrhea, the bright red blood from your lungs, giving up the Drano or baby formula, or whatever was used to cut down the boy. People had died trying to leave H on their own. The drug was vengeful. It owned you. It clawed into your skin and wouldn't let go. Lucy had seen its cast-offs laid out in back rooms and vacant parking lots. Their flesh desiccated. Fingers and toes curled. Their nails and hair kept growing. They looked like mummified witches. Weeks, months, years. The stifling August heat had been broken by what could only be fall temperatures. Cool mornings, cold nights. Was winter coming? Was it still 1974, or had she missed Thanksgiving, Christmas,
her birthday. Sands through the hourglass. Did it really matter anymore? Every day, Lucy wished that she was dead. The heroin was gone, but not a second went by when she wasn't thinking about that high. The transcendence. The obliteration. The numbing of her mind. The ecstasy of the needle hitting vein. The rush of fire burning through her senses. Those first few days, Lucy could still taste the H in her vomit. She tried to eat it, but the man had forced her to stop. The man. The monster. Who would do something like this? It defied logic. There was no pattern in Lucy's life to explain why this was happening. As bad as some of her Johns were, they always let her go. Once they got what they wanted, they tossed her back into the street. They didn't want to see her again. They hated the sight of her. They kicked her if she didn't move fast enough. They shoved her out of their cars and sped away. But not him. Not this man. Not this devil. Lucy wanted him to fuck her. She wanted him to beat her. She wanted him to do anything but the loathsome routine she had to endure every day. The way he brushed her hair and teeth. The way he bathed her. The chaste way he used the rag to wash between her legs. The gentle pats of the towel as he dried her. The look of pity every time her eyes opened and closed. And the praying. The constant praying. Wash away your sins. Wash away your sins. It was his mantra. He said nothing directly to her. He only spoke to God, as if he would listen to an animal like this man. Lucy asked, why? Why her? Why this? She screamed at him. She begged him. She offered him anything, and all he said was, wash away your sins. Lucy had grown up with prayer. Over the years, she had often found solace in religion. The smell of a burning candle or the taste of wine could send her back to the church pew, where she happily sat between her mother and father. Her brother Henry would scribble crude drawings on the bulletin, bored nearly to death, but Lucy loved listening to the preacher extol the vast rewards of a godly life. On the streets, it gave her comfort to think about those sermons from long ago. Even as a sinner, she was not completely without salvation. The crucifixion meant nothing if not to redeem Lucy Bennett's soul. But not like this. Never like this. Not the soap and water, not the blood and wine, not the needle and thread. There was penance. And then there was torture. 4. July 7th, 1975. Monday. Amanda Wagner let out a long sigh of relief as she drove out of her father's Ansley Park neighborhood. Duke had been in rare form this morning. He'd begun a litany of complaints the moment Amanda walked through his kitchen door and not stopped until she was waving goodbye from behind the wheel of her car. Feckless veterans looking for handouts. Gas prices through the roof. New York City expecting the rest of the country to bail them out. There was not one story in the morning paper about which Duke did not share his opinion. By the time he'd started listing the seemingly endless faults of the newly organized Atlanta Police Department, Amanda was only half listening, nodding occasionally to keep his temper from turning in the wrong direction. She cooked his breakfast. She kept his coffee mug filled. She emptied his ashtrays. She laid out a shirt and tie on his bed. She wrote down directions for thawing the roast so she could fix his supper after work. Meanwhile, the only thing that made it all bearable was thinking about her tiny studio apartment on Peachtree Street. The place was less than 5 minutes away from her father's house, but it might as well be on the moon. Stuck between the library and the hippie compound along 14th Street, the apartment was one of 6 units in an old Victorian mansion. Duke had taken one look at the space and snorted that he'd had better accommodations on Midway during the war. None of the windows would properly close. The freezer wasn't cold enough to make ice, the kitchen table had to be moved before the oven door could be opened. The toilet lid scraped the side of the bathtub. It was love at first sight. Amanda was 25 years old. She was going to college. She had a good job. After years of begging, she'd finally managed, by some miracle, to persuade her father to let her move out. She wasn't exactly Mary Richards, but at least she wouldn't pass for Edith Bunker anymore. She slowed her car and took a right turn onto Highland Avenue, then another right into the strip mall behind the pharmacy. The summer heat was almost suffocating, though it was only 7:45 in the morning. Steam misted from the asphalt as she pulled into a parking space at the far end of the lot. Her hands were sweating so badly that she could barely grip the steering wheel. Her pantyhose were cutting into her waist. The back of her shirt stuck to the seat. There was a throbbing ache in her neck that was working its way up to her temples. Still, Amanda rolled down her shirt sleeves and buttoned the tight cuffs at her wrists. She dragged her purse off the passenger seat, thinking the bag got heavier every time she lifted it. She reminded herself that it was better than what she was wearing on patrol this time last year. Undergarments, pantyhose, black socks, navy-colored polyester blend pants, a man's cotton shirt that was so big the breast pockets tucked below her waist, underbelt, metal hooks, outer belt, holster, gun, radio, shoulder mic, kel light, handcuffs, nightstick, key holder. It was no wonder the patrol women of the Atlanta Police Force had bladders the size of watermelons. It took 10 minutes to remove all the equipment from your waist before you could go to the bathroom, and that was assuming you could sit down without your back going into spasms. The kel light alone, with its 4 D-cell batteries and 18-inch long shaft, weighed in at just under 8 pounds. Amanda felt every ounce of the weight as she hefted her purse onto her shoulder and got out of the car. Same equipment, but now that she was a plainclothes officer, it was in a leather bag instead of on her hips. It had to be called progress. Her father had been in charge of Zone 1 when Amanda joined the force. For nearly 20 years, Captain Duke Wagner had run the unit with an iron fist, right up until Reginald Eves, Atlanta's first black public safety commissioner, fired most of the senior white officers and replaced them with blacks. The collective outrage had nearly toppled the force. That previous chief, John Inman, had done basically the same thing in reverse seemed to be a fact lost in everyone's collective memory. The good old boy network was fine, so long as you were one of the lucky few who were dialed in. Consequently, Duke and his ilk were suing the city for their old jobs back. Maynard Jackson, the city's first black mayor, was backing his man. No one knew how it would end, though to hear Duke talk, it was just a matter of time before the city capitulated. No matter their color, politicians needed votes, and voters wanted to feel safe. Which explained why the police force gripped the city like a devouring octopus, its tentacles spreading in every direction. 6 patrol zones stretched from the impoverished south side to the more affluent northern neighborhoods. Spotted within these zones were so-called model cities, precincts that served the more violent sections of the downtown corridor. There were small pockets of wealth inside Ansley Park, Piedmont Heights, and Buckhead, but a good many of the city's inhabitants lived in slums, from Grady Homes to Techwood to the city's most notorious housing project, Perry Homes. This West Side ghetto was so dangerous, it warranted its own police force. It was the sort of job returning vets clamored for, more like a war zone than a neighborhood. The plainclothes and detective units were posted across the zones. There were 12 divisions in all, from vice control to special investigations. Sex crimes was one of the few divisions that allowed women in any numbers. Amanda doubted very seriously her father would have let her apply for the unit had he still been on the force when she submitted her application. She cringed to think what would happen if Duke won his lawsuit and got reinstated. He'd likely have her back in uniform, performing crossing guard duties in front of Morningside Elementary. But that was a long-term problem, and Amanda's day, if it was like any other, would be filled with short-term problems. The primary issue each morning was with whom she would be partnered. The Federal Law Enforcement Assistance Association grant that had created the Atlanta Police Sex Crimes Division required all teams to be comprised of three officer units that were racially and sexually integrated. These rules were seldom followed, because white women could not ride alone with black men. Black women, at least the ones who wanted to keep their reputations, did not want to ride with black men, and none of the blacks wanted to ride with any man who was white. Every day was a battle just to figure out who was going to work with whom, which was